Okay, so welcome everybody to the Early Buddhism course number 3. And for this week, we're going to be looking at the topic of ethics. And this will be as part of, we've done our introduction and we have part of 3 workshops, this one and the next 2, which are dealing primarily with the important content of early Buddhism. Now, when we were thinking about this course and designing the course, we wanted to include a number of different aspects. One of the aspects was what we've looked at in the last couple of workshops, which is the history, the background, the techniques we use, how do we know what's early and what's late, and so on and so forth. And these are the things which we've looked at previously. But we also wanted to make sure that we focused on the content, like what is the early Buddhist teachings actually saying. So that's the main focus of the next 3, and then the final workshop will be on mainly focusing on application. So how do we take these teachings and use them? Of course, that's always relevant at every stage, but the last workshop will be focusing specifically on that aspect. Now, when it comes to okay, what content are we going to present? Then, of course, there's so much, right? And we have thousands of suttas. So many teachings that the Buddha gave over his 45-year teaching career. So there's many, many different things that we could have chosen for the content of early Buddhism. But, of course, we went through a very profound selection process, mainly consisting of thinking, well, we had 3 weeks, so we had to find something that had 3 in it. So we present 3 of something. So then we thought, okay, well, sila, samadhi, panya, that'll be good enough. Okay, ethics, concentration, and wisdom, or ethics, samadhi, and wisdom. So this is one of the main frameworks in early Buddhist teachings. Of course, in presenting it in this way, we're neglecting the Four Noble Truths and the dependent origination and so on and so forth. But of course, all of these teachings are interlinked. And this is one of the most important aspects of the way the Buddha presented his teachings, and quite an astonishing thing, really. You can draw out the facets and the connections between the teachings in so many different ways. And when you become familiar with them, then you start to recognize the patterns that are recurring, and then that gives you a much richer context for understanding everything. So anyway, the Sila, Samadhi, Panya, ethics, Samadhi and wisdom, ethics, meditation and wisdom, is a core framework. It's very important, so we thought, well, that will be good for this course. Now, in looking at ethics this week, as before, we're going to have a mixture of meditations, talking and discussion and so on. And so the idea will be the aim of the course this week is to get a good understanding of what the Buddha was teaching in terms of ethics, both in terms of the underlying principles of ethics and also in terms of the actual ethical principles that the Buddha was advocating. Now, I've had a couple of technical hitches this morning, so don't be surprised if we have some more. But one particular technical hitch we have is that I can't see what's on that screen exactly. Okay, so when it was just a slideshow, then we're fine. But when we come to looking at the actual suttas, I'm going to have to watch that screen up there. I can't see it on my computer, so it'll be a bit of at least the Buddha had to do the elephant look, right? So that would have been even more convenient. He would have had to sort of go around like that. But at least I can turn my neck. So that's hopefully it will be a bit better. And as before, during the teaching, you're most welcome to ask questions. But during the teaching itself, please keep the questions to clarification and issues that have arisen during the teaching themselves. And for longer points of discussion, then that's what the discussion groups are for. Okay, so the scope of ethics. Okay, what is ethics about? Well, we have an idea of what ethics is about, right and wrong, good and bad, and so on. There's a number of different words that we use to describe ethics. You know, in modern culture, ethics is usually the preferred term, and I've gone with that here. A somewhat more old-fashioned term is morality. Morality tends to be associated with religion, right? And basically uptight old people telling young people what to do. That's basically what morality is, has this kind of connotation. another word which we sometimes use, of course, the Pali word that we're using here is sila, and sometimes to translate sila, Bhikkhu Bodhi uses virtue, which has its virtues as a translation, but what I think what Bhikkhu Bodhi is trying to capture with that is that sila has a broader scope than ethics does in our modern, the way we use it in modern times. On the other hand, virtue has some problems. For example, you can have bad sila, dusila, but you can't really have bad virtue. It doesn't quite work, does it? Anyway, that's just a translation issue. But the main point here is that we're dealing essentially with ethics or morality. We won't get too caught up in the definitions of things. But one thing that I think we should notice right from the beginning, and I'll talk more about this as we go on, is that the scope of sila is a broader scope than ethics as it's considered usually in our modern culture. And I think this is a very important distinction. The structure of the course for today, three main parts. To begin with, we're going to have a short look at the theory of ethics. What is ethics about? And the two critical aspects of ethics that the Buddha talked about. One was intention, okay, and this is the karma, is the intention, and happiness. Right? So good moral conduct leads to happiness. This is very, very important. There's a very close relationship between moral choices, ethical choices, whether good or bad, and happiness or sadness. These things are very, very closely linked in Buddhism. Second thing we're going to look at is the actual practice of ethics, so the various precepts. You're probably familiar with the five precepts, which is very common teaching in Buddhism and sort of undertaken at every main Buddhist ceremony, certainly in the Theravadan world. But the Buddha taught precepts in a number of different ways, and we're going to be looking at a slightly more elaborate formulation, which is called the 10 paths of wholesome action, the Dasa Kusala Kamma Pata. It's essentially very similar to the five precepts, but has a slightly different emphasis. And finally, we'll be looking at purpose and context. How does ethics fit in with the rest of our life? And to me, of all the distinctive features of Buddhist ethics, this is the one which I think is, for me, was the most powerful in terms of the actual ethical precepts, not to kill and so on. I already knew about those things before I encountered Buddhism. But how ethics had a meaning, a greater meaning in terms of your overall spiritual development and liberation. This is something that I'd never really encountered at all before coming to Buddhism. So for me personally, this is a very important aspect. Okay, so why theory? So what do we talk about ethical theory for? Well, the first thing we should recognize is that ethical theory has a very limited relationship to ethical choices, right? Most of us don't, when we have to make a choice about what's right or wrong, we don't sort of think, well, my particular ethical theory that I abide by is utilitarianism, and according to utilitarianism, we should consider points A, B, and C, and therefore, if I consider point A in relation to this thing, so therefore, I should do X, Y, Z, right? And normally, that's not how we make ethical decisions, right? We have a feeling about what's right or wrong, right? We have a gut feeling, and we go with that. So that's how humans work. So our point here is not to judge that, right? We're not trying to say that this is either right or wrong way to do it, but the point is simply to recognize that. So it's given the fairly self-evident fact that most of our ethical choices are guided by emotion and intuition and so on, rather than by reason, I think it's therefore valid to ask, well, what's the point in trying to even develop a theory of ethics, okay? And this is something which in ethical philosophy is a kind of perfectly valid point of view. And so one solution to this problem, as advocated by some contemporary moral philosophers, is to say, well, there isn't any point in developing a theory of ethics as such. All we can do is observe how people in fact practice ethics and then try to make generalizations about that or try to understand what people do in practice. But there's no real point in trying to develop a theory of it. I think that's a little bit pessimistic. I do think that people are not completely irrational. Okay, we're fairly irrational, and we're often irrational even when we think we're being rational, right? But we are capable of reasoning, and given that we are capable of reasoning, given that in some cases reason is one of the things that affects our choices. Okay, it's not necessarily the only thing. In fact, it's never the only thing, but it's one of those things. So I think it's at least reasonable to say, well, let's clarify how we're going to think about this, which is basically the point of ethical theory. So these things become more pressing when we have difficult choices. Okay, if something's obvious, right, then never mind. Right? We don't have to rely on a theory. But when it comes down to the crux of things, when you start to think about, you know, these very controversial things, you know, just a few things you look in that's happened in the world in the last few days. You know, we have had these kind of bombings in America. We've had riots in Burma. We've had the gay marriage thing. New Zealand's legalized gay marriage, yeah, and so on and so forth. So it's all these different issues, and all of these raise a number of very difficult and controversial ethical problems, which we have to consider and have to try to deal with. And we can see that so often, when we respond to these ethical problems, we do so just without thinking. We just this is right and that's wrong, and people become very dogmatic about it. So if we have some kind of ethical theory, it gives us a framework, it gives us a way of reflecting. Well, if we ask, we can ask ourselves, well, you know, if we look at it in this light, we can reflect on it and say, well, is that really the right thing to do? So again, we shouldn't expect too much from a theory. This is something that I problem that I had when I went to university and I studied philosophy and I did ethics at uni, and I kind of was very naive and I was kind of expecting to be able to, you know, that you can find a way of sorting out all the problems, right? You can sort of look at any ethical problem and sort it out, right? If you only think about it hard enough, you can work out what the right thing to do is, because the reality isn't that black and white. So we can't expect too much from an ethical theory, but at least in some cases it might be able to help us to make a more clear and beneficial decision. My opinion is that modern ethics is deeply impoverished. And I noticed this for the first time when, many years ago, first became really conscious of it many years ago, well, I think it was before I became a monk, maybe 20 or so years ago, and I saw a Time magazine, and I can't even remember what it's about now, but it was talking about genetic research or something like that. I think it was something about genetic research, maybe stem cell research or something like that. And they had like a big chart, like a two-page chart, about, you know, what's the ethical thing to do, what are the ethical considerations regarding this particular kind of research. And I was looking at all of these things, and it really kind of struck me that nothing on that page was talking about what I would consider ethics. The only thing that it was talking about was what people are going to object to. Right? What can we actually do without people raising a fuss about it? Yeah, these are the kinds of things that people will get upset about, right? And that becomes what's ethical. What ethical is what you can do that nobody's going to make a fuss about. Yeah, and when a few years ago, I got a invitation to sit on the board of the Human Research Ethics Committee in Royal North Shore Hospital. Okay, so that they, as a research and teaching hospital, they get various proposals to do kinds of experiments on human beings, right? So this isn't like cloning and those kinds, not that kind of experimentation, but things like when new medicines have to be developed and so on and so forth, sometimes psychological testing, sometimes it would be like workplace behavioural studies, all kinds of things that came up, cancer research, various kinds of things. So. And these all have to go to an ethics committee. And so I sat on this ethics committee for a year and I'd have to come down from Bundanoon and come there. And it's like, I think once every 2 months or something we met. And you'd have like a stack of research proposals like that. You had to sort of read through every couple of months. And everybody had to, every research proposal had to do a submission to the ethics committee. I'm sure some of you have been through this process. And so we had to sit around and have different representatives, you know, so there'll be like a scientist and there'll be a doctor and a lawyer and so on and so forth, and then a couple of community representatives, so I was there as a community representative, and you have to figure out, well, is this ethically okay? And what I thought really struck me after doing this was how, first of all, how middle class it all was, right? It's all like, is somebody going to be offended if we say X, Y, Z in the instruction, you know, guidelines for this? You know, this was the kind of thing. It's not about, like, you know, chopping people's heads off or doing these kinds of terrible experiments or anything. It was like, you know, we've got a questionnaire. We want people to fill out this 5-point questionnaire on how they felt after they went home after having a medical treatment in the hospital, right? And, you know, how are they going to feel about if we ask the question this way or that way? And that was what the ethics was about, right? And almost never did we actually ask any deeper questions, right? And one case where this became out very strongly for me was one cancer medicine that we had, right? So a proposal for particular medicine for treating the chemical for treating particular kind of cancer, fine. And justification for it, scientific justification for this was, a couple of years ago, we introduced another kind of cancer medicine for treating this same kind of cancer, but that has now stopped being effective. People's immune systems have adapted to it, so now that one is not effective anymore, so we need to introduce this new one. Right? So on one hand, fair enough, but on the other hand, surely that's raising a much deeper ethical question about what kind of approach we're taking to treating diseases if we're going to keep on doing all of this testing and introducing new medicines all the time and they're going to become outdated so quickly. Surely there's a deeper issue to be looked at here. But that deeper issue didn't come within our scope, right? We couldn't consider that. All we could consider was this application in this means. So this is what I mean when I'm saying that the ethics is impoverished. If there's no consideration of deeper questions, there's no consideration of what does this mean within my life as a whole, right? That wasn't an issue that was raised. It's simply what is going to be acceptable. That's all basically what ethical is. What can you actually get by the ethics committee? If I can get it by the ethics committee without anybody objecting to it, then it's ethical. Right? So, by comparison with the Buddhist practice of ethics, I think it's very much an aspirational ethics, right? It's not just what can I get away with, right? But what is the very best way that I can live my life? Yeah? How can I live my life in the most compassionate way possible? How can I live my life in the most wise way possible? How can I live my life in order to benefit myself and to benefit others to the greatest degree that I possibly can? So this is, I think, the strength and the depth of the Buddhist approach to ethics. Now, I would say that's probably true of most traditional approaches to ethics as well. When I say that the modern ethics is impoverished, it's not necessarily meant as a criticism. I think, yes, it is a criticism to some degree. It's very limited. But I also understand why it's like that. Okay, it's like that because we deal in a multicultural society, because things are very complicated, and because sometimes just getting by is all we can hope for. Right? So it's not necessarily to criticise that. The very fact that the ethical choices we were making were so trivial showed that nobody was actually making unethical proposals for research, which they might have done if the committee wasn't there, right? So again, it's not necessarily to criticise that. I think that it's doing a good job within its scope. It's just to acknowledge that scope is a fairly shallow one, that's all. Okay, so we've been sitting for a little while, so let's sit meditation for the next 10 minutes. Okay, so if we look at different theories of ethics, I won't go into this in any kind of detail, but just to note a few common forms of ethical theory that we find around the place. Perhaps the most common one we find today or in practical usage is the theory of rights. So the theory of rights, of course, is embodied in things like the Bills of Human Rights and so on, and legal instruments. And theory of rights says something like that, just to make, if we make an ethical statement to say that this is right or this is wrong, so to say something is right means that somebody has a right to do that. To say something is wrong means they don't have a right to do that. What a right is, well, you can tell me if you like. I've never quite been able to figure it out. And I think that one of the big problems with the notion of rights is that there's a number of problems with it. One is that it's never entirely clear to me what a right actually is, and it's also problematic in that it tends to be more limited to saying what is again this idea of what is acceptable, right? So you know, you have a right to an education or something like that, but doesn't actually say tell you what is the best or what you should aspire to. But the language of rights, these things, they're just ways of talking about ethical issues and talking about if human rights is good enough for some purposes. But I'm not particularly convinced by it as a sort of complete theory of ethics. Another way of talking about ethics is divine command, right? So something's wrong because God said, don't do it. Something's right because God says, do it. And of course, this also is followed, believed by many people around the world. These things aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, of course, right? There's many people who maybe believe in God and the divine command who also follow theories of human rights and so on. So they're not necessarily exclusive, but they're just different ways that people think about ethics. So again, the notion of divine command is problematic in a number of respects. Obviously, from my point of view, I'm an atheist. I don't believe that there is a God who goes around saying, do this and do that. So that's a bit of problematic. Secondly, I think it's problematic because I think it's immature to make ethical decisions based on what somebody tells you what to do. I think we should be able to make up our own minds what's right and what's wrong. And thirdly, it's problematic because, of course, everyone's got their own God, and God's tend to tell different people to do different kinds of things. So this also is a problem. I mean, the fact that we use the language of rights so commonly in the international forum is precisely because of some of those problems. It's an attempt to evolve a language where we can talk about ethics in a way that's acceptable to people from all different backgrounds. Yeah? So this is why I have this idea of universal human rights. Of course, it's being questioned about whether they are really universal, but anyway. Another way of theorizing about ethics is subjectivism, and this is developed by a number of modern moral philosophers. Essentially, subjectivism closely related to the idea of relativism, but it's basically the idea that when I say something's right, what I mean is I like it, or I mean I want you to do it, right? Something like that. So it says that ethics doesn't have any more content to it than that. An ethical statement is really just a disguised statement of my preferences or of my wishes or something like that. And so this obviously again is a response to the fact that, you know, we found as our global awareness of different peoples has expanded and grown so much, we found that different people around the world have very different approaches to ethics and so on. And so rather than seeing one objective way of looking at right and wrong as being based on what God said or something like that, perhaps we just need to give up the notion of a universal ethic at all and just recognize the fact that different people like different kinds of things, and we can't objectively say that one is better than the other. So this is subjectivism, again, closely related to relativism. And then the final kind of ethical theory, which I think is the best one, is the one called utilitarianism. And utilitarianism essentially says that what's right is what makes you happy, or what leads to the greatest happiness. It's formulated in various different ways, famously developed in the West by John Stuart Mill and other English moral philosophers. What's the phrase that says it leads to the greatest happiness for the greatest number, something like that. And there's various different ways of formulating utilitarianism, but the essence of it is that there's a link between moral choices and happiness, right? And to me, the reason why this is the best of the moral theories and why I think it's the most powerful one is because it's something that's meaningful and that we can know about. We can know whether this choice leads to happiness. Does this make you happy? We can actually ask someone. We can find that out. We don't know, is this following the divine will of God, right? Is this something that's an inalienable human right? Well, I don't know. Where's human rights apart from a list that somebody drew up of human rights? So these things to me are based on ideas that are very abstract and ultimately unknowable. Whereas utilitarianism has problems, no doubt, but at the very least, it's based on the reality of human psychology and, I think, broader, I think, animal psychology as well. So this is why I've always been attracted to utilitarianism as what I think is the most grounded ethical theory. And to me, it makes sense that you know, doing what is right is what leads to happiness. It seems obvious to me. You can't make the right choice, which in a deep sense is going to lead to suffering. Of course, in a shallow sense, it might, right? I mean, you might do the right thing and some people might get upset with it and so they suffer, but still it's the right thing. So, of course, there's always complications in how these things play out in the real world. But we shouldn't let that the complications blind us to the basic principle. So, this is utilitarianism. Now, I believe that the ethical theory of the Buddha was essentially a form of utilitarianism. Okay, and I think that he preempted the Western utilitarians by about 2,500 years. And not only do I think he preempted them, I think he solved fairly effortlessly a number of the most serious problems that Western utilitarianism has and still struggles with. When I say that early Buddhism is a form of utilitarianism, the basic reason for saying this is because the Buddha also made that very, very strong connection between what is right and what leads to happiness. Yeah? Choose what's wrong, it leads to suffering. Okay? And we've seen this in a number of the readings which you have for the course today, and we'll have a look more of them as we go on. But this basic principle, what's kusala, what's good, is what leads to happiness. What's bad is what leads to suffering. So if we formulate our ethical principles in that way, right, we've done a number of things. First thing is that we have dispensed with any notion of God or somebody telling you what to do, or this is right because it's what the culture says is what it's right, or what the fathers say is what is right, or what it says in some book says what is right. What's right is what something that's psychological. So, secondly, what is it not only dispenses with this whole range of different approaches to ethics, it's also something I think which is very empowering, because it says to each person that they have the wisdom to be able to decide what's right and what is wrong. Not only do you have the wisdom to decide that, but you also have a means to evaluate that. And that means is this going to lead to happiness or suffering for myself and for others? Right? So we can test that. Now, of course, we don't always know, right? We can make an educated guess, right? And sometimes we're right and sometimes we're wrong. It's never perfect. So we're not trying to suggest that it's perfect or it solves every problem, but it does solve some kinds of problems. Okay. Now, some of the key differences between the form of utilitarianism as taught in the suttas and the form of Western utilitarianism, one is, of course, the notion of rebirth and karma. It's very central to early Buddhism. And this, of course, solves one of the glaring problems with utilitarianism as formulated in the West, which is that how come so many bad people seem to be so happy, right? Does anybody here remember the great Australian comedy series Australia Is Standing In It? Yes, we have a nod from the back of the room. And you remember the favourite spot on Australia Is Standing In It was, what was it called, Brain Space. Yeah, was it Tim and Debbie? Brain Space, is that right? Yeah? Okay, so a few people remember. And one of the Brain Space ones, yeah, I still remember this after all these years. And there were these very kind of very hip alternative types who thought that they were so better than everybody else, but in fact were not hugely mentally endowed. And they were talking about how wealth doesn't make you happy. And then one of them saying, yeah, but as I was coming here today, I saw this guy driving along in this Mercedes and he looked really happy. And Tim says this, and then Debbie says, yeah, but he wasn't really happy. And Tim says, well, he had a really big boat behind his Mercedes and so on. Look pretty happy to me. And so what's going on there? Why is it that some people apparently do nothing, right? And get lots of wealth and happiness and so on, have a good life without seeming to deserve it. Other people struggle, mainly you and I, right? Struggle all our lives and work really hard, and then what do we end up with? Huh? The world doesn't seem to be automatically just. And this is something which is specifically addressed in the early Buddhist texts, places like the Mahakama Vibhanga Sutta and many other places where the Buddha addresses specifically this problem. And what he says is that the reason why this seems to be the case is because we don't have enough information, right? We're drawing a conclusion, but we don't see the full picture yet. And if we were to see a broader picture, then we could see that if we take into account rebirth and past lives and future lives, and we realize that, well, somebody can do in the past is a mixture of both good and bad karma, and some of that good karma might fruit in this life, but then in this life they're going and doing bad things, so then that bad karma will then fruit in the future. So if we can expand our scope and see how that plays out over a long period of time, then we can see that that principle still holds good. Now, this I think is a very important principle, and this is, I think, a challenge. I know that in modern Buddhism, especially in secular Buddhism, a lot of people don't really believe in rebirth, so that's fine, but I think one of the challenges for people who want to look at Buddhism from a secularist point of view or without considering rebirth, then this problem then rears its ugly head once more. Okay, so this problem doesn't, I think, is solved perfectly adequately if we take rebirth into account. If we don't, then that problem is there just as present as it is for Western utilitarianism. Now, of course, it's merely a problem, right? It doesn't mean that it's wrong. And, of course, Western utilitarian philosophers like Peter Singer and others have addressed this issue in various kinds of ways. So it doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong. I'm just saying it's obviously an issue. Second issue with utilitarianism is, what does pleasure mean? Right? So we say what's right is what leads to the greatest happiness is the greatest number. Well, what's happiness? And so we have to, if we want to make this approach to ethics stick, we also have to have a good psychology, right? So we're in fact linking morality and psychology. And just as, say, with a divine decree form of ethics, we have to link ethics with theology, right? So now we're having to link ethics and psychology, and so we have to have a good understanding of what human happiness is. Of course, that's not completely obvious, is it, right? I mean, again, there are many simple cases where it's obvious that you do the right thing and it does lead to happiness. On the other hand, there are many cases where there are conflicts, and particularly I think the most important kind of conflict is the kind of conflict between a short-term happiness and a more meaningful form of happiness. And I think we encounter this kind of ethical dilemma constantly, and it's got a classical one that happens when you're in some kind of relationship, either in the family or at work, and something comes up which is going to be hurtful or painful, and do you tell them or do you lie about it? Right, and so in the short term, everyone's going to be happier if you just say a white lie, and then you know you don't have to actually deal with it. But usually, well, in the long term, it usually makes it worse. Right, so this is the kind of issue which is a problem, and which in any kind of utilitarian theory has to address this problem by an understanding of human happiness. What are the different kinds of human happiness? And I remember when we were talking about this in my philosophy lecture, and the lecturer says, you know, Am I going to be happier by, sitting? I think that sitting and reading a book by a moral philosopher is a better thing to do than to go to a party and get drunk. Okay, but I'm not convinced that it's going to make me happier. Right? So why is it that one is going to be happy? So in that case, of course, you think, well, in the long term, it might be harder work to study the book of the philosopher, but it's going to lead to more wisdom and more understanding and so on. Whereas going to the party is going to be happy at that moment, but then you wake up in the morning with a hangover and you feel bad about yourself and so on. So there's these different kinds of short-term and long-term happiness. Now again, this is something which is addressed very directly in early Buddhism, and which in fact is quite core to the early Buddhist teachings. And the Buddha talked about happiness a lot and suffering. And he talked about the different kinds of happiness that we have. The happiness that comes from sensual pleasure. The happiness that comes from family and relationships. The happiness that comes from doing good. It comes from ethics. The happiness that comes... And then various kinds of happiness which are far more profound and which are only just starting to be considered within the scope of modern psychology. For example, the happiness of deep meditation. Right? And even further than that, the happiness of liberation or enlightenment. So these things are all considered within that, and the ethical implications of actions are considered in the light of these more profound, more and more profound forms of happiness. Yeah.
I had the idea that original utilitarianism was more about the greater good, that there was this idea that it was the greater good rather than the greater happiness, and then it required, of course, somebody to say,
what is the greater good, yeah.
Good good, but it was a bit different to the greatest pleasure that those people, the poor, who were educated, to get.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, but I think that that then becomes the issue within utilitarianism, is exactly what it is. I remember talking with, I went to a talk this last year with Peter Singer in Melbourne. Peter Singer, of course, a famous Australian philosopher, and he's a utilitarian philosopher. And he was saying, you know, because he's quite elderly now, and the purpose of this lecture was to discuss exactly that point and to say, well, there are two forms of utilitarianism which are commonly regarded today. One is called hedonic utilitarianism, and the other is called interest utilitarianism. So hedonic utilitarianism is what's good leads to the greatest happiness, the greatest pleasure, and then interest utilitarianism is what leads to what's in the best interests of people. Right? And all his life he's basically been an interest utilitarianism, but now he was reconsidering that. He hadn't made up his mind, but he was thinking, maybe I was wrong all along and I should be a hedonic utilitarianism. Yeah. And again, I think it's the same point comes in there, is that considerations of pleasure and pain are not simple, but they're at least more graspable, more empirical than the consideration of what's in someone's interests. It's a very kind of vague notion. So if possible, you know, I always think it's better to base it on what's as concrete as possible. Yes.
When I first became a Buddhist, maybe, I don't know, 10 or more years ago, I went to a talk and someone had written a book on Buddhism. I can't quite remember the name or title. Mm. But they were saying that babies born with various disabilities, that represented bad things they've done in previous life. Mm-hmm. And I can see how a belief in rebirth and karma can solve one problem, but I think it creates another problem, which is victim blaming almost, and a lack of charity.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree with you more. But that's not the early Buddhist point of view.
Yeah.
Okay? Quite.
So they would specifically exclude, like, if you're born into a low caste or with a disability or some disadvantage.
Right. This is the kind of view which is almost universal in pretty much any form of traditional Buddhism today, but is explicitly denied by the Buddha many, many times in the early Buddhist texts, okay? So this idea, this deterministic view of karma. In fact, it was a Jain view. It was the Jains held it at the time, and the Buddha specifically critiqued it on a number of grounds. And you can look at, say, the Devadaha Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, and many other places. So what the Buddha said was that karma is an influence. So karma is a cause, and like other causes, it plays itself out in combination with everything else. Okay? That karma is not the only thing that causes things. And specifically, for example, you have lists in somewhere like the Girimananda Sutta, where the Buddha lists the various causes of diseases. Right? And it goes, a long list of diseases is diseases caused by bile, by phlegm, by pus, by blood, disease caused by change in the weather, by unaccustomed activity, by violence, and so on and so forth. And one of those is karma vichapakaja avada, is a disease which is caused by the result of karma. Yeah? So the result of karma is one of the things which is playing its role, but it's not a deterministic thing. Right? So you can't say that this result was caused by that, by karma.
It's a very poignant to those viewpoints.
Sorry, I'll come back to you in a second.
I was just wondering, could you just say the names of those sutras again?
The Devadaha Sutta. Devadaha. Let me just put it up for you. I actually had a conversation on this very point. Devadaha Sutta, Majjhima 101.
Talking about the Bija Nikaya, the Bija, Niyama.
The five niyamas is a commentarial teaching. So we don't find that actually in the suttas as such, but the principle of it, I think, is the same as what we find in the suttas. Yeah, but the actual five niyamas we don't find. Okay, so here's the Devadaha Sutta, so we should always look at the parallels. This is on the new site, Sutta Central, which is completely awesome. you can read it in Vietnamese and English and all kinds of things. And so I'm just going to show off. Okay, so this Devada Sutta has one Chinese parallel. And here's the Pali text. If you don't speak Pali, then you can use a Pali dictionary. So it's pretty cool, right? Right? Cool. That's pretty cool. Okay. Of course, if you don't prefer to read it in Thai, then that's fine. So I'm just showing off here. Okay, so this is the Devaraha Sutta. Okay, so Majjhima Nikaya. So again, that's just one of the places. Yeah, Giri Mananda Sutta was another one. Giri Mananda, Gudra 10s. Giri Mananda, 10.60. Oh, one Tibetan parallel. There you go. Didn't know that. Okay. So, back to the slideshow.
So, Ajahn, if I may clarify, would the karma be the cause of the deformity or the whatever the illness at the time of birth, and then how it pans out is...
No, not necessarily. It could be many things. It could be genetics, it could be, you know, the physical...
But the genetics is nothing to do with the karma?
Well, I'm not sure whether it's nothing to do with. It might be associated with karma in some way, but again, not necessarily in a deterministic way.
Wouldn't it be why
should it be? For a start, one thing to always remember is that according to Buddhism, certainly I think according to all forms of Buddhism, is that rebirth in the human realm is always as a result of good karma. Right? So whatever kind of human birth you're in, you've had some good karma in the past, right? Now, if you have some kind of illness or a disability or whatever, then one of the causes that can lead to that can be karma. You know, and you think about that, that's just the same, but there also can be other ones. It's just the same as in this life, right? If you say, well, why are people sick? Right? Well, one of the causes for people to be sick is because they have bad karma, because they went out drinking and driving and smashed their car, right? And they got injured, right? And sometimes that's the case. Other times, it's not the case, right? It had nothing to do with their choices. They were walking along the road and a television fell on their head, right? It had nothing to do with them. Right? It wasn't their karma that made the television fall on their head. It was someone dropping the television off the top story. That's what... It was the drunken rock and roll stars. That was their bad karma, right? It wasn't the... It wasn't the person walking underneath. Nothing to do with their karma. They were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Okay, so I was just the other week when I gave a talk at the Australian Association of Buddhist Studies, and there was a Sri Lankan lady there from Brisbane who'd come down, and she's actually doing her thesis on this particular point. And she herself is disabled. She's doing it on disability and Buddhism, and was looking at the way that this doctrine of karma is basically crippling the help and services for disabled people in Sri Lanka. And that was her basis of her thesis. And comparing that with the representation of these things in the early suttas, one example of course being the Lakunta Gambadia, who's the dwarf, who was like a hunchback dwarf or something like that, who was a monk and praised by the Buddha as being a great arahant with psychic powers. So quite clearly there's no kind of ethical issue there. Okay, so this is one issue. So, but again, but that was a very... Oh, I said, you had a point.
And unfortunately it happens a lot in ethnic Buddhist countries, this idea that everything that happens to somebody is the result of karma.
Yeah.
And that seems to be what's taught in these countries as well, which makes it even more worrisome. A real misunderstanding of the teachings of the Buddha.
I find it astonishing. It's not as if it's even controversial in early Buddhism. Mm. Yeah. I mean, if I think about the people that I know, right, who have studied the suttas and so on, and who have a reasonable knowledge of it, then of course we will still disagree about all kinds of things, right? But everybody that I know who has actually studied the early suttas agrees with that. It's not controversial at all. Right? I haven't met a single person who's contested that. And yet, it makes almost no impact on mainstream Buddhism. It really struck me once, a number of years ago, I was at a conference in KL, on a global Buddhist conference, and one of the speakers there was the American Zen philosopher David Loy, who's a very excellent teacher and gave a very good talk. But one of the things that, as he gave his talk, he said with this kind of inquiring tone and almost surprised tone that he'd read somewhere that in the Pali canon that it said that not everything is caused by your karma. So even someone like David Loy, who's highly educated, highly intelligent, very reflective, and after studying Buddhism for, 20 or 30 years, has only the vaguest notion of this is that, or maybe this idea is there. Yeah.
I wonder just about the ethics of kind of saying that things are entirely karma. If you have a disabled child or whatever, then it, in a way it strikes me as a form of damnation. And that in itself is against what you were saying before about the utilitarian approach, that being, you know, acting in a good way is via the karma.
That's right, and the karma is how do you respond compassionately, right? Is that, that's the karma that you're making in that moment. Yeah, that's the important thing. So, you know, I think this is a great example of how important it is to have some understanding of what the suttas are saying, have a historical perspective on early Buddhism, so that we're able, when we hear these things, because these are not just abstract ideas. These are things that have a very, very real impact on people's lives. And we should have be clear with ourselves about these things, and we should also speak out about it and make sure that these misunderstandings of the Buddha's teachings don't then lead to harm. Again, coming back to this connection between what's ethical and what leads to harm. Yeah. Okay. So the third aspect of Buddhist ethics, which I've already mentioned before, which I think is a major difference between early Buddhist ethics and utilitarianism, is that early Buddhism places ethics within a much more meaningful context. And again, while utilitarianism is more or less content, I think utilitarianism is better than some other forms of ethics in this way. You know, it's this idea of leading to the greatest happiness of the greatest number. So it's still, it has some kind of aspirational quality, right? It has, whether we phrase it as happiness or the good of the greatest number or what's in the interest of the greatest number, it still has that thing where we can actually aspire to be better rather than simply getting by. So it does have that to some degree, but it still doesn't really have a deep spiritual context within which to phrase what really is within people's interests and so on. And I think that's applied also by Buddhism. Okay, so it's a bit after 10 now, so let's sit in meditation for another 10 minutes. There are a number of qualities that ethical actions have in Buddhism. The first one, I think the most significant, is that ethics is intentional. In this way, moral choices are quite... This is one of the points of distinction between the Buddha and Jainism. And Jainism believed that you committed karma, you created karma, whether your actions were intentional or not. So if you walked along the path and you squashed an ant, then you get bad karma for squashing that ant, even if you didn't see it, right? And you didn't know about that. Whereas from a Buddhist point of view, it's only acts which are intentional which create bad karma. Now, on the one hand, this is a very very rational, very sensible approach. On the other hand, it does raise its own problems. Okay, for example, does that mean that if I'm walking along the path and I don't care whether there are any ants on it, right? So I just sort of, I don't even look, and I kill all the ants. Does that mean I don't get any bad karma? Because I haven't intended to kill any, right? So perhaps we might in that case consider, well, there was a lack of intention to be compassionate. Yeah? So it's still something, there was a lack of intention to be mindful. Anyway, I don't want to solve all those problems, but I just want to point out that this attribute of intention is not completely unproblematic, but on the whole, it's a very important aspect of looking at ethics. So the quality of intention is shaped by the forces that lead to that intention. Now, again, one of the innovations in Buddhist psychology, one which is not phrased in this explicit form beforehand, is that you have a distinction between a motivation and an intention. Okay, so a distinction between where you're coming from and where you're going. And this is something that the Buddha brought out quite explicitly in a number of different contexts. So, for example, where you're coming from, motivation is often expressed in terms of, say, greed, hatred, and delusion, or non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion, right? And I've expressed this here in the positive sense, right? So non-greed is generosity, and non-hatred is love, and non-delusion is wisdom. So we can have those things, but there's a difference between having those things and acting on them, okay? And so, for example, you might feel angry at somebody, yeah, but then you don't actually necessarily make any karma because of that feeling of anger, right? The feeling of anger is just a feeling. But then you say something, you actually, even if you think something, right, you might have, it doesn't have to be external, it can be a malicious intention internally, right? May they wither and die, and may all of their children to the seventh generation wither and die, something like that. So you might think like that, and of course that's making bad karma even if you don't do anything about it, okay? So you have bad mental karma, and expressed through, usually said to be expressed through body, speech and mind. And we see that in a number of the different suttas that we say. So the motivation is very important, but the motivation doesn't determine the action. This is very important. And so this is from a Buddhist point of view, this is where mindfulness and reflection and so on comes into play. We can realize, oh, actually, I'm feeling very greedy, right? I want to take that extra bit of cake and leave none for anybody else, right? And you still have that greed, but you don't have to act on it. So there's that extra step of being able to reflect that. So the Buddha made that distinction between motivation. So this is why the intentional action here is said to be based on generosity, love, or wisdom, or vice versa, of course. Okay. Second aspect, again, is what we mentioned before, is that ethical action leads to happiness for oneself and others. Notice that happiness is not just for oneself, okay? And this is something which is expressed, again, very commonly and very explicitly right throughout the suttas. You know, if you do this act, it leads to your own benefit, it leads to the benefit of others, and it leads to the benefit of both. Okay? And it leads to the benefit of the whole world. The Buddha said this so many times, you know, do this for the benefit of the whole world, sabbaloka hitaya. In one of the almost clichés, if you like, of Mahayana Buddhism is that, you know, from their perspective, that the Hinayanas, who they regard as early Buddhists, were selfish. They only acted for their own benefit. Okay, and so it's interesting to consider that criticism. First of all, how obviously that criticism doesn't apply to what we find actually in the early Buddhist teachings, right? That the Buddha was teaching again and again and again for the benefit of the whole world and so on and so forth. But on the other hand, it's unlikely that those Mahayana teachings and criticisms, it's unlikely that they have no basis in reality, right? They're not just something, that's not just a fantasy, right? It's something which actually has a purpose. What I think the purpose is that it's a response to the Buddhism, which was which was being practiced and was experienced by people at that time being about 500 to 1,000 years after the Buddha. And I think that what had developed in India by that time was forms of Buddhism which was in fact very selfish, where people were in fact just practicing for their own benefit and not caring about anybody else, and that these suttas were composed so on partly as a critique of that and to get people to have more broader consideration of ethics in their practice. So this is one way of looking at it. Now, you see, if you look at that from a sectarian point of view, then you sort of dig yourself into holes, don't you? We're Theravada, so we're right because this is what the Buddha really taught, and Mahayana is not authentic, and so therefore you're wrong, right? And Mahayana's like, well, you're all just kind of selfish and limited, and you have no. And so you dig yourself into these sectarian holes, and there's no way of digging yourself out of it. But if you look at it from a historical point of view, and if you have an understanding of early Buddhism, then you can see, well, actually, each of those things probably has a point, right? And that they are different responses that people are making, which might not be absolutely true, right? But which has an understandable purpose and meaning within a particular context. Yeah? So this is, I think, a good example of how to see this kind of evolution of these ideals. There was an interesting study by Venerable Analio. He looked at that particular question, and particularly in context with a particular sutta called the Bakula Sutta. And Bakula Sutta is a very interesting one because it's one which is only found in the Pali Canon, it's not found anywhere else, and there are many features of that sutta which show that it's a late addition to the Pali Canon. And again, as we saw in the discussion of text critical theory in the last workshop, that when we have late texts, that we can often identify that they're late with a great degree of certainty because there are multiple independent criteria all pointing to the same conclusion. And the Bakula Sutta is another example of that, where there is many indications that it's late, including the fact that the traditional commentary says that it's late and says that it was added at the Second Council 100 years after the Buddha. And in the Bakula Sutta, you have this extraordinary long list of things which Venerable Bakula is being praised for, okay? And which there's this like chorus of people saying, sadhu, sadhu, this is a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Venerable Bakula. And then it's all things like, in all the years he's been a monk, Venerable Bakula has never sewn a robe for another monk. Sadhu, 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 this is a wonderful and marvelous quality. And all these years as a monk, Venerable Bakula has not even... It starts out, somebody who's a former friend of Bakula asks him, since you've been a monk, how many times have you had sex? Right? And Bakula says, since I've been a monk, I haven't even had a thought of sensual desire, much less have I had sex. And they go, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And then it goes on and on, there's a whole kind of series of things. How many times have you taught novices? I've never taught novices since I've been ordained. Sadhu, sadhu, this is a wonderful and marvelous quality. And the whole kind of thing. Very strange, right? And obviously this is a shift in the whole ideal of what arahantship meant, as opposed to the ideal that you see, say, Venerable Ananda or Venerable Sariputta and so on, who are constantly acting out of compassion and for the health, welfare of all the people around them. You know, stories you read of Venerable Sariputta, that he would always be the last one to leave for Pindavata, right? For alms round, right? Even though he's the most senior monk, he would always wait till all the other monks had gone out, and then he would go around the whole monastery and shake out the foot wiping rags and put away anything that needed to be put away, or sweep anything that needed to be swept to make sure the monastery was nice and clean and tidy. Yeah? So this is kind of the behaviour of someone who's a real arahant, right? And so someone like Bakula, and mentor. Well, I don't know if you find it so inspiring. But then, and this is very controversial within the tradition, the later texts in the Avadana Shataka, Ashoka Avadana has King Ashoka paying visits to the stupas of all the great disciples, right? And so he goes to each one of the stupas, the Buddha, and then Venerable Sariputta, Venerable Moggallana, and Venerable Ananda, and at each one he goes with this monk, Upagupta, who's like his tour guide. He takes him to all these things and he explains all their great deeds, and then he offers, you know, mountains of gold to each one of the stupas as an offering. And then he comes to Bakula, and then he says, what did Bakula do? And then he told him what Bakula did. And then King Ashoka says, well, I'll give him a copper penny. So, you know, clearly this was, you know, controversial within the tradition, right? There were these different discussions and so on. So again, when we see this, we can understand, well, there's a historical context for why this accusation of selfishness was there. And again, there's, you know, the figure of Bakula obviously must be based on, well, somebody thought it was a good idea. Okay, so it leads to happiness for oneself and others. It's doable. And this is very important. I think I'll just come and have one of the suttas that we had. So this is the Kusala Sutta. Abandon what is unskillful. What is akusala? It is possible to abandon what is unskillful. If it was not possible, I would not say to you, abandon it. But because it is possible, I say to you, abandon it. If this abandoning of what is unskillful were conducive to harm and pain, I would not say to you abandon it, but because this abandoning of what is skillful, unskillful is conducive to benefit and pleasure, I say to you abandon what is unskillful. And then of course the reverse for what is skillful, develop what is skillful. It is possible. Okay? And this is, I think, very, very important to understand, that the Buddhist point of view is it is possible. Again, to contrast with some other perspectives on ethics, one of the things that we hear often, for example, in the Christian sphere, is people say, well, basically we're all sinners. We're born sinners and we're going to die sinners and we can never really be good. Yeah? I mean, not all Christians say that, but a lot of people do. And so it's the idea that you're attaining for something which is forever unattainable. As the Buddha was saying, you can do it. Right? Very, very clear. And again, notice the connection between what is good and what is, and what leads to pleasure and what leads to happiness. So this is a very nice sutta. Very kind of briefly and very powerfully encapsulate some of those important principles of Buddhist ethics.
Yeah. I'm not sure where I can read it. Can you please tell me why? It said there was a Buddha looking all directions to see whether anyone else might realize that each one of us is self-more, and therefore, if we love our life the same way we value our life and we don't harm someone to us, then we should think about it and then go to the same way into the animals. Is that a commentary or is it?
I'm just trying to think. I can't place it. Certainly is in line with the ethics that's taught in the early suttas. I can't think off the top of my head of a place that says exactly as you've put it there. It's yeah. Let me think about it some more. I'll see if I can think of a reference for it. Yeah.
I think that one is a queen. The king and the queen are in love, and they're asking.
That's the story. Exactly, yes. That's the story between Pathanidhi and Queen Mallika. Yeah. So that's in the Samyutta Nikaya. Okay. Okay, so that's the Kusala Sutta. Okay, and so it's doable and it encompasses all beings, right? So that ethics is not just restricted to my tribe, my family, my nation, my culture, my ethnic group, my religion, whatever. But all beings, not even just all humanity, but all beings. And again, I think this is a distinctive quality of Buddhist ethics. It's not unique to Buddhist ethics. Certainly, other forms of ethics have this scope. Jain ethics certainly does, and most forms of Brahmanical ethics, at least in their developed form, also have this idea of all sentient beings. But I think Buddhism. Possibly, possibly following Jainism was one of the earliest religions to really make this very explicit and very core right from the beginning that this is what we're talking about. Sabbe sattā bhavantu sukhinantu, may all beings be happy. So this is very important. And when I was preparing the slides for this workshop, I just Googled early Buddhist ethics, and then came up with, well, of course, Google gives you a number of fairly random responses to that. And so this was one of the ones that I got. And this is Angulimala with his mum. So I just thought I'd throw that in there. And there's the Buddha, and on the bottom it says, "Stop," says Angulimala to the Buddha. So of course the story of Angulimala, I just want to mention this here, as another aspect of Buddhist ethics, is that Buddhist ethics always has this possibility of redemption. Yeah? And it's also very, very important. Angulimala, the world's first serial killer, and had murdered and laid waste to the countryside, and was, according to the traditional commentary on that story, was just about to kill his mum. And so then the Buddha came along and taught him and so on, so saved his mum from being killed. And Angulimala was able to be redeemed and to become a monk and become an arahant. So in those days, if you ordained somebody as a monk, then even the cops would stop looking for you, right? So King Pasenadi came to the monastery and they're looking for Angulimala, and he said, well, what if I was to tell you that Angulimala had now become a monk and that he'd given up killing and harming and so on? And the king's like, oh, well, that's all right. So there's not this kind of notion of justice, right? We've got a ball in mouth, he's got to pay, and you know, all of that stuff. He's actually changed. He's not doing that anymore. So that's all. There's no question of punishment. Yeah. Sorry?
The point is that it's okay to me that he became a disciple, but to become an arahant, then you sort of think, well, what about all this business about bad, even in one lifetime, to get other lifetimes, the bad karma didn't stop him becoming an arahant. A disciple.
Well, it's an extreme case, yeah. So, but I think the main message of it is that there is that possibility of redemption. But also as a matter of principle, I think becoming enlightened doesn't mean getting rid of all your bad karma, right? Becoming enlightened means understanding what karma is. Yeah, it's about understanding. So you don't have to, you can have as much bad karma as you like and still get enlightened.
I think I was working under the assumption that I didn't really look into it, that karma would prevent you bad karma would prevent you becoming enlightened.
Yeah, no. I mean, traditionally they say the five anantarika karmas will prevent you from becoming enlightened, right? And that was why the Buddha, again, according to the tradition, actually in the sutra it doesn't mention Angulimala's mother at all, but according to the tradition, he was about to kill his mum, and then that would have been stopped him, right? Because killing your mother and father and arahant and so on is what that can stop you from getting enlightened. But actually that part of the story was added later. But generally speaking, you don't have to get rid of all your bad karma before you get enlightened. Enlightenment is about understanding the nature of causality. It's not about getting rid of all your bad karma. And again, this is quite explicit in the early suttas. The Buddha criticizes the Jains for exactly this point, and they say, we're here to wear away our old karma. And the Buddha says, well, how much old karma have you got? They say, well, we don't really know. Because how much have you worn away? We don't really know. How much are you wearing away by doing all these ascetic practices? Well, we don't really know. And how long are you going to have to keep doing it before you've worn all the karma away? Well, we don't really know. And so then they say, well, we're happy with it, we're going to keep doing it anyway. It's actually a very realistic account of most people's religious practices, isn't it? We just keep doing it, Whatever, we just keep doing it. So again, you don't have to get rid of all your bad karma to get enlightened. Enlightenment is about understanding. It's not about getting rid of your karma. Yeah. Oh, that's also the Devadaha Sutta I mentioned before, Majjhima 101. Yeah.
But if there's one karma that prevents you, is your bad karma that does not prevent you from going in the right direction?
No. Karma is what you choose to do.
So your bad practices are going to stop you?
No. Karma doesn't stop you from doing anything. Yeah? Karma influences you. Right? So karma is an influence, but it doesn't stop you. And again, karma is not a magical thing. Okay? Karma is just cause and effect. And the way karma works is exactly what we observe when we observe our own lives. Right? And when you observe your own life and you observe the life of others, then you can see, well, these things play out in all kinds of different ways, and there's no fixed deterministic relationship between it. Some people are bad when they're young and they're good when they're old. Some people are good when they're young and they're bad when they're old. Some people commit terrible crimes, seek redemption for it and become wonderful people. Other people sink further and further and further into the mire, and so on and so forth. So that karma, the things that you're doing in the past, of course that influences you, but it doesn't determine you. So what determines our life now is the choices we make now, not the choices we made in the past.
I was just thinking, it sounds like the karma as a principle is saying the buck stops here. It's up to you what you choose to do.
Yeah. Pretty much, yeah. So that's why it's a very much an adult approach to ethics. Yeah, it's about accepting responsibility. So this is why the precept is always samadhiyami, I am to take the precept. Yeah.
Is that why I understand Buddha says be skillful, be wise.
You can infer there's nothing outside the frame of reference. That your karma is not seen as an object, but so it's inclusive to your self-understanding, to etc. Be a total frame of reference.
Right.
So if you rejected it, you could be throwing away the best part of yourself.
Yeah.
Because in some ways, that could be liberation as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's a very good point. So, and I think that's not just a theory. Also, I think that's very real in people's lives. It's the very mistakes that we've made, which is the ones that we learn from. Mm-hmm. So, it's not getting rid of those karmas; it's understanding them, and not repeating them, obviously.
But then, when they become arahant or become enlightened, then they pass away, doesn't that sort of then, basically the whole cycle has finished?
That's right, yeah.
So that bad karma or whatever, that's all, then just doesn't play a part in it.
That's right, yeah.
But at the same time, if you are enlightened, and until you die, you can get upaka, that you can die of pain.
That's right.
Just because you are enlightened, that doesn't mean.
Sure. The very fact that you have a body is the result of your past.
So once you pass away, then
that's right.
Okay, on that premise, if the very fact that you have a body is based on your past karma, then the very fact that your body is deformed would also be positive. Exactly how we, as the Aya said, coming from a traditional background. We were taught like that, and you can't think otherwise.
The very fact that you have a body is also dependent on genetics. Mm-hmm. It's also dependent on evolution. It's also dependent on your parents. Mm-hmm. It's also dependent on eating food.
Yes,
it's also dependent on all of those.
The way we would have been taught long ago would have been the choice of your parents. The parents that you get, everything is dependent on your karma. Karma is like this
all-pervading. That's right, and if you're walking along the road and the television falls on your head, it's because of your karma.
It makes it in a funny way for
And when you have a tsunami and a million people drown, that's because a million people all had exactly the same karma.
You question those
funny
things, but...
but you understand what the point that I'm making. It's not that it's not nothing to do with karma, but it's that karma is one of the forces that's playing itself out in combination with all kinds of different forces.
But by example, it could be a good karma that you survive this one.
Exactly. Yeah.
And everybody around you.
Well, it could be. Yeah. Yeah. But again, the important thing is not is this karma caused, is this tsunami caused by karma and all of those kinds of things. The important thing is when the tsunami actually happens, what do you do? How do you respond to it? This is the important thing. Yeah. And one story of one of my friends was in this tsunami and desperately managed to save his family, and they were in a hotel, and then afterwards, and there was one group of tourists there who basically got as much food as they could in the aftermath of the tsunami and then locked themselves in a room and wouldn't let anybody in, right? So that's how they chose to respond to it, right? That's their karma, Well, so many other people responded with compassion and kindness. Yeah. Anyway, let's have a break now for a cup of tea, and we'll come back at 11 o'clock for the first discussion group.